Hello and welcome to this AAT podcast, which is my top 10 tips for handling a direct tax inquiry. My name is Gary Brothers and I head up the tax investigations team at RSM Bentley Jennison. Having a face perfect for a podcast, you won't be able to see that my boyish good looks show that I've had over 20 years, both inside the Inland Revenue and then in practice, dealing with tax inquiries, investigations, interventions or reviews. Call them what you like. And for the purpose of this podcast, I'm going to call them all an investigation, so bear with me. But what I want to talk about is some practical tips for successfully and painlessly navigating a tax investigation. But let's get a couple of things straight right from the start. And we will come back to this. Firstly, none, and I do emphasise none of this podcast, is about misleading the inspector or keeping anything away from him or her just to mitigate the tax amount. I operate on the basis of full disclosure of the facts. Anything else risks your reputation with HMRC and is far more damaging in the long run than a quick win. I give my clients in investigations three golden rules that they must stick to. One, never lie to the inspector. Two, never lie to the inspector. And three, and you've probably guessed this by now, that's right, never lie to the inspector. So please remember that. None of this podcast is about misleading the inspector or not disclosing appropriate matters. Next, regardless of some of my comments, tax investigations are not wars, or at least they shouldn't be. Tax inspectors, like any other large group of people, are on the whole thoroughly decent, hard-working, pleasant people. I should know, I used to be one. In a tax investigation, remember, the inspector is just doing his or her job. Yes, there are rules by which both sides should abide, and we'll talk about those later, but inspectors are just doing their job. What these tips are designed to do is to give you some help and insight into what you can and can't do in an investigation and, above all, how you can expect some control over the whole process to make it as quick, as concise and as painless and also as cost-efficient for both fees and tax as possible. So, what is all the fuss about? Well, if you're in practice, you may well help a client negotiate or navigate this sensitive path. With 210,000 investigations conducted, in the year to March 2007, that's one every 2 minutes, then a price of being in business for our clients is the chance of having to do business with the taxman. Even with the new regulations that come into force from April 2009, the investigation arena doesn't really alter massively. There are a number of new procedures, some more sensitive than others, that we as practitioners need to understand, but the focus of an investigation, which is a fundamental and thorough inspection of a person's trading activities and wealth against that already declared, hasn't changed for years and there's no prospect of that changing in the future. So here are some practical tips to help you and your clients through the investigation. But, just a reminder before we begin, these are to control the process and nothing more. So, tip number one, take a deep breath and don't be scared of the ride. And like all rides, it might get a bit bumpy, or your client might get a bit nervous. That's understandable. For the inspector, an investigation is common, and they just won't understand how nervous the scrutiny makes our clients feel. That's not the inspector's fault. He or she is only doing their job. We do, though, need to get some early controls in place. One, of the client. Two, of the paperwork. And three, of the inspector. So let's start with the client. Firstly, and remembering my full disclosure point, has the client done anything wrong? That's not an easy conversation to have, but I do think it's better for us to have it and then to control it than the inspector. If we're happy the answer is correctly no, that's great. If the client does admit to something wrong, then let's tell the inspector straight away and put some brownie points in the bank. The other conversation I would suggest with the client, and again, not an easy one, is about the fees he's going to have to pay. On average, an investigation lasts 18 months. That's letters, meetings, reviewing documents and records, and also reviewing the inspector's work. All in all, our costs will be higher than traditional accounts preparation or tax return completion. The initial letter from HMRC, I would suggest, is the right time to talk to the client about costs. Secondly, I said let's control the paperwork. An 18-month investigation will produce a lot of paper, letters, schedules, meeting notes, computations. If it's not stating the obvious, a tax inquiry file is a must. The inspector will run his investigation from one file, with everything relevant at his fingertips, so why shouldn't we be equally well prepared? Then, the final aspect to control is the inspector. Some more detailed tips shortly, but initially, use the first letter as the opportunity for a conversation with the inspector. This lets you see what makes the inspector tick, and also shows the inspector that you know how everything works, you have skills and experience, and so will be a competent and able adversary. Not in a confrontational or aggressive way, but in a professional and knowledgeable way. Remember, more than anything else, that our client ultimately is the customer here. HMRC tell us that all of the time. The investigation should be little more than checking our client's activities to ensure a correct return of income has been made. It is not the start of war. So, that's tip number one. Calm the client down. Take some of their understandable concern away. Get the admin or housekeeping sorted out and make contact with the inspector to see if we can establish some rapport. Tip number two, I would suggest, is know your rights. This is something I believe passionately in, simply because if we're trying to influence some control or direction, then we need to know what the rules are. When I was young, my dad used to say to me, "Son, only pick a fight you've got a chance of winning." And they were wise words and a truism for tax investigations. Now, I'm certainly not saying pick a fight, any fight with the inspector. What I do mean, though, is know exactly what is and is not expected by us and our clients, and also know exactly what the inspector can and cannot do. Knowing that is professional and correct. Any contact between HMRC and our clients is done under the protection of a Code of Practice, or COP, and these are most commonly COP 3, COP 14, COP 8 or COP 9. These are sent by HMRC so our clients know how the conduct of the investigation will go. Now here's an honest question for you. If you've handled an investigation, did you read the Code of Practice? Now answer honestly. If you did, then well done. And if you didn't, then why not? The Code of Practice is an important piece of material HMRC have sent you. They are saying, these are the rules of the game for both sides. If you're going to control the investigation and look after your client, you need to know those rules and how to use them. There is also nothing wrong with knowing them and using them. That's why HMRC sent them to you in the first place. Let's hope you don't need to tackle an inspector about them trying to do something in your investigation that they shouldn't be, but until you read the Code of Practice governing your investigation, then ask yourself just how you're going to know if they are doing something they shouldn't. Tip number three is what I would call be an inspector. Now, by saying be an inspector, I don't mean change your job. I do mean try to think like them. That way, you're one step ahead of what's likely to happen. It's not easy, and I know that. These guys are well trained, in fact very well trained, on investigation techniques. So what can we do to get back on a level playing field? Well, the next question I've got for you, and again, you've got to answer honestly, is when was the last time you read any of HMRC's manuals on their website? A long time ago or never? If that's the answer, you're missing a trick. I know you're going to say that you don't need to read the revenues manuals because you've got one or other of the wealth of reference material that's available to us as practitioners, but there's nothing wrong in that. I use them myself regularly. The other criticism I hear from practitioners is that they don't want to use the HMRC manuals because they're too pro-revenue. It is true that the HMRC manuals are the guidance for the inspectors of HMRC, and it is for their own interpretation of the legislation and how it should be applied. I've got no problem with that. It's fair that inspectors have guidance just like we do, and it makes sense that their guidance give their views and interpretations. But the point I am making is that in an investigation, you disregard this material at your peril. Ignore it, and you will not know what or how the inspector is encouraged or even instructed to approach each part of the investigation. If you read it, you don't have to agree with it. Our own reference material gives the practitioner's perspective, but at least use the revenues material to understand where and how the inspector will plan to take the investigation. It's like I said earlier, it's all about control, and you can't control something if you have no knowledge of it. Take a tip from me. Go to the HMRC website. That's www.hmrc.gov.uk. In the top right-hand corner, click on Tax Agents, and then down the right-hand side, click on Manuals, and they're all there for you to review. If it's an investigation query, then look for the inquiry manual. Like I said, you might not agree with the content, but you will at least know how the inspector is told to conduct his investigation. Tip 4 deals with the request for information. Now, I'm not here to bash inspectors. I've said that a couple of times. This is about control, management and focus. However, it is true that there is some difference with some inspectors between what the law allows an inspector to get and what the inspector might ask you for. The inquiry manual deals with this point too. Legally, the inspector can ask for whatever he or she wants. If us or our client agree the request and give the information, then that is voluntarily provided, and we have no recourse if we then find we didn't, in law, have to hand some of that over. The HMRC view is that if a request is made and information is provided, then that is fine and thank you very much. Where HMRC will not support an inspector is where something is requested that cannot be required by law, and the inspector then, incorrectly, attempts to use their legal powers to obtain that information. Such a situation, in my experience, happens only very rarely. But back to the information. The legal powers currently available are either paragraph 19, Taxes Management Act 1970, for income tax investigations, paragraph 27, Schedule 18, Finance Act 1998, for corporation tax investigations, or Section 20, Taxes Management Act 1970, for more serious investigations involving either tax. Basically, if the inspector requests information or documents from the client in connection with the investigation, and that information or documentation is not forthcoming, then the inspector can back up the request with a production notice. If you get such a notice, check its validity, and some of the defences which I'll mention in a moment. However, if all is in order, get whatever is requested to the inspector as quickly as possible, as failing to do so can result in financial penalties for the client and will also lead to higher final penalties if any further tax is due. So, what about those defences I mentioned? Well, before that, a word of caution. If you use any of the defences, make sure it works and handle its use sensitively, as there is a perception issue here. I have no problem using a defence when appropriate. After all, that's why it's there. But please beware being seen as uncooperative or putting up needless barriers. It will do your credibility no good at all if you fail with your use of a defence and, in addition, will undoubtedly fuel the inspector to think that he's onto something, so be careful. The two most common defences are the possession or power test and the reasonableness or relevance test, so a word on both. For any request for information or documents from the client to be enforceable, the information or documents must be in the possession or power of the client. Possession is very straightforward. Can the client lay their hands on it? Do they effectively own it? If yes, then it's in the client's possession and should be provided, subject to the reasonableness or relevance test, of which more in a moment. Power, however, is a little more tricky. This is where the client does not have possession of the information or document, but is where the client can make whoever does have it give it to our client. The important point for a power consideration is that the client can make the holder give the item to them. In other words, our client does not have it in their possession, but still has power over it. That is an altogether different test and should be critically considered by practitioners. The next test is that any information or document sought should, in the inspector's reasonable opinion, be relevant to the inquiry. This is, of course, a very subjective test, but is a safeguard for clients against the inspector simply fishing. In suitable cases, and again the perception point I mentioned earlier is very much valid here, it is perfectly acceptable to request the inspector to explain why something sought is relevant to the inquiry. However, please choose your battles carefully. If you make this challenge to an inspector where he has requested the business books and records in an investigation, you will be thought of as uncooperative and obstructive, as that is clearly a perfectly acceptable, relevant request within the law. If, however, the inspector extended that to spouse or children bank and building society account information, then the defence starts to look much more valid. So, in summary, never be afraid to understand the defences and to use them, but please only in appropriate circumstances. Tip 5. To meet or not to meet. First things first, the inspector has no right to meet your client. If your client does not want to meet an inspector, then they don't have to. It says that clearly in the codes of practice. The inspector does want to meet your client, though, to, frankly, use some of their interviewing skills on your client. Remember, none of this is about not being honest with the inspector. But meetings with clients are a problem because once the client says something in a meeting, it's on the record. And it's then extremely difficult to challenge or change that information. Furthermore, and in my experience, clients will say all sorts of weird and wonderful things to an inspector in a meeting for no other reason than they're nervous, stressed, and want to be as helpful as possible to make the investigation end and go away. Unfortunately, helpful doesn't always equal correct, but once it's said, it can't be unsaid. In my view, there are only ever three people who should meet with the inspector in an investigation. Number one is the advisor. Number two is the advisor. And again, I'm sure you've guessed, number three is us, the advisor. The inspector will be frustrated if you do not make the client available for interview, but think who has lots to gain and who has nothing to gain. Please believe me, I continue to believe that the advisor role includes direct dialogue with the inspector, including meetings, but clients should be left to do what they do best, which is running their businesses. So, on the assumption that the client is not meeting the inspector, but we, as advisors, are, my two main tips for meeting the inspector are, number one, location, 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 and number two, forewarned is forearmed. So firstly, location. This is a pretty easy choice, really. Always at our premises if we can, and if we don't have accommodation, then at HMRC's own offices. Remember, the client is not in attendance at this meeting, so either venue is okay. For the removal of doubt, never, ever, never ever at the client's premises. Not because we've anything to hide, full disclosure remember, but simply because it's intrusive and too sensitive a location. And so to the second point, forewarned is forearmed. Please always ask for an agenda. To be fair, and ahead of meetings, some inspectors will provide an agenda without being asked. However, if you read those manuals that I mentioned earlier, you'll see that inspectors are advised to provide agendas only when requested. That's requested by us. It makes absolute sense too to ask for an agenda. The inquiry manual recognises this, saying that due to the costs of our attending any meeting with the inspector, we should have sufficient detail and opportunity to prepare properly for that meeting. So the other part of this tip is not only to request an agenda, but to request one that is detailed enough so that you can prepare for the meeting that's coming. As an inspector, and wanting to maintain an element of control, I've sent out agendas saying 1. Introductions, 2. Business activity, 3. Record keeping, 4. Private matters, and 5. Any other business. And I still see those agendas today. There's not a hope of preparing properly for any meeting with that agenda, and I would absolutely recommend going back to the inspector and getting a meaningful agenda so we can prepare properly for a well-ordered and productive meeting. Tip number 6 is always be realistic. Ask yourself as a practitioner, honestly, what do you hope to achieve or obtain from this investigation? There is a lot to be said for being goals-driven when it comes to investigation work. Let's put this simply. If the client's business records are poor, full of holes and badly ordered, then there is a far higher chance of the inspector picking something up when compared to a client who diligently attends to his books regularly and keeps them in excellent order. So be honest with the client. None of us are miracle workers, and clients shouldn't expect us to be. We are, after all, only as strong as the client enables us to be. This tip then really is about client handling. If the client has unrealistic expectations of us, then there will be difficulty ahead. Also, what about the inspector? What is he experiencing from this? And, more importantly, can we guess what he's told his boss he's going to get from this? This, for the advisor, is fairly classic piggy in the middle, or, as I prefer to see it, requiring us to act as an arbiter between the inspector and our client. and sometimes in that role, our function is to recognise fairly the strengths and weaknesses of both sides' arguments and to find a way to broker a conclusion between the two. I call it finding the point of least dissatisfaction to all. Tip 7 deals with concluding the inquiry. At long last, we've got to the end, but hopefully more quickly after these tips. So, the end is in sight. Happy days. This is where our skills as negotiators have a real financial impact. Remember, fully disclose all material facts. I am, though, happy to try to negotiate wherever I can to get any tax bill due to an absolute minimum. So, what can we negotiate on? Well, the answer is pretty much everything, although the art is in knowing when, where, and how to press the inspector to reduce any amount of the settlement. So, let's think through the logical way of minimising a tax settlement by entirely legitimate means. Firstly, the investigation will usually be in depth for only one return year or accounting period, with the inspector then wanting to adjust any other years as a consequence of and by reference to whatever he establishes in the period under inquiry. Given then that this year or period sets the mark for other consequential periods, it makes sense that the smaller the adjustment in the inquiry period, the smaller the consequential amendments with a corresponding overall reduction in the total settlement cost. So, firstly, let's work as hard as possible to get any inquiry period adjustments as small as is possible. Those savings will then be replicated many times over in the other years of adjustments. Next, ask yourself the question, should we be amending any other years at all? Inspectors rely on what they call the assumption of continuity for disturbing the other years. That is, if the inspector finds that a client has underdeclared income for a particular period, then it is likely to have gone on undetected previously, so the inspector has a right to bring other years into line with his findings. But is that always correct? Look critically at those other years for features or aspects which mean either no disturbance or perhaps a restricted disturbance is due. This will largely depend on the particular circumstances of each case and is highly variable, but it is also highly valuable to consider nonetheless. What about the years involved? Well, usually it's the inquiry year or the inquiry period, plus the previous six, plus any later years if later returns have been filed without alterations to bring them into line. So, for an inquiry that's run 2 years, we could easily be looking at 8 or 9 years of potential adjustments. The question I would pose is, in those circumstances, is there anything at all to be lost by haggling or negotiating with the inspector over these years? And of course the answer is absolutely not. The worst the inspector can say is no deal. He certainly won't increase the years concerned. If the inspector says deal though, you get the chance to drop some years out of the settlement. Always good news. Now this is pure horse trading, but if you don't ask, you certainly won't get. So what's to lose? One word of caution though. The settlement comprises tax, interest and penalties for the adjusted number of years. We've seen how to reduce the tax and the years, and we'll do penalties separately as a single tip. I do, however, want to mention interest. The interest element of a tax investigation settlement is recompense for the government for not having had the tax on time. Because of that, there is a three-line whip that the interest amount is non-negotiable. that rule is sacrosanct and won't be undermined or moved on, so please don't try. What I always say to practitioners is the best way to reduce the interest charge is to reduce the tax along the lines we've discussed. So, we'll discuss penalties in a moment. Is that the end of the story as regards settlements? Well, the answer is no, not quite. Again, where we might be able to help the client is with time to pay. Now, if the client wants a monthly plan to settle his investigation amount, the inspector may give this, but he will want to charge interest for the duration of this deal. But most settlements not by instalments are payable within 30 days of the final agreement. So here's a challenge. Can you get a more favourable period without instalment interest? What about 60 days or 90 days to clear the liability with no added interest? It all helps the client and it all helps the client's cash flow. The best I've ever managed is 180 days or 6 months with no extra interest charge. I couldn't quite believe it, but like I've said, if you don't ask, you don't get. And if you can beat that deal, please let me know. So, tip 8, penalties. For now, I'm talking only about the old penalties. That is those penalties that existed for the pre-April 2009 period. Obviously, we have a new penalty regime from April 2009, and be warned, the old and the new will coexist side by side for 20 years due to the way HMRC's discovery powers works. That takes me through to retirement, thanks. So, this is really an overview of the old penalty rules. Firstly, for any penalty to arise on the settlement, we need two things to happen in the investigation. Firstly, we need a loss of tax, or more properly, extra tax being due as a result of the investigation. But, and in addition, that extra tax arising has to be due as a result of at least the negligent conduct of the client, and furthermore, the inspector has to demonstrate the client's negligence. So, please be aware, the onus of proof is on the inspector to establish that your client has been negligent. Now, that's sometimes very easy to show. For example, if sales have been purposefully understated, then that's an easy case to make. But in other cases, it's a lot harder to make. For example, if the final adjustment is a complicated technical matter, then is the client really negligent for not understanding the consequences of the filing position taken? So, at least review that negligence point. And remember, it's the inspector that must show negligence to be entitled to a penalty. So, assuming negligence exists, how do the penalties work? Remember, these are the pre-April 2009 old regime penalties. Well, the penalty is a maximum of 100% of the tax due. So, if the investigation shows extra tax due of £10,000, then the penalty can be up to a further £10,000 on top of that. However, the inspector is expected to discount back from 100% or the £10,000 by looking at disclosure, cooperation and seriousness. So let's look at those. Disclosure is how open the client has been about any failings. If the client or us on the client's behalf disclosed early on that there were problems, and remember tip one, controlling the client, then we get a higher discount. if the client denied any problems throughout, despite evidence to the contrary, then the discount is much, much smaller. The maximum discount available for disclosure aspect is 20%. The next area the inspector looks at is cooperation. So, if there were no delays in providing information, documents or explanation, then there's a bigger discount available. If problems arose and a payment of tax in advance of conclusion, known as a payment on account, was made, then this is better still for getting a big discount for cooperation. On the flip side though, if there were delays, or perhaps the inspector had to use his formal production powers to get information, and remember what I said in tip 4, then the discount will be smaller and the penalty will be higher. The maximum discount is 40%, so there can be a lot at stake. One other thing I do want to mention on cooperation. Please also realise a genuine disagreement about a position or fighting your corner is not a lack of cooperation and shouldn't result in a higher penalty. That's in the HMRC manuals again. The final area to consider for penalties is seriousness, and like cooperation, there's a maximum 40% discount available. Unlike both disclosure and cooperation, this is one area the client cannot influence during the conduct of the investigation. The client can choose to make a disclosure or not, if one needs to be made, of course. And the client can choose to cooperate or not. So, for both, the behaviour of the client can affect the penalty amounts. Seriousness, however, relates to the size and scope of any problem areas, and there is little a client can do to change that. If you follow the tips here, then you should expect any penalties to include at or near the full 20% for disclosure and at or near the full 40% for cooperation. That would then leave only the final 40% for seriousness, and that would depend on just what has happened. Tip 9 is always, always close it down. Now this tip applies throughout, which is why it's near the end. Basically, I'm suggesting that in any contact with the inspector, you try to conclude a point, at least one, because if you do that, then you're one step closer to concluding the investigation completely. There is no hard and fast advice here, but rather a case of concentrating your attention on the real or underlying concerns, and a suggestion that you can set out to either resolve those concerns or agree it as a problem area, still then closing the issue, albeit with an adjustment of some sort attached to it. The sooner you tie off all of the concerns, then the sooner you will reach the closure you are aiming for, which is good news for the client. Tip 10, and the final tip, is what I call a colleague down the corridor. In other words, when you need it, seek some help or find someone to discuss the more tricky or problematical areas with. When I started as an inspector, advisors could pop into the tax office and have an intellectual debate about a tax issue with a view to resolving that matter. For better or for worse, that access to HMRC is no longer available. Restructuring and office closures has resulted in investigations being undertaken many miles from where a client is based, and it is sometimes difficult to have anything other than the briefest of contacts with the inspector concerned. So, if a sense check is needed, find a kindred spirit within the profession. Some level of support can be the best defence. So, I hope that you found these thoughts helpful. If you find yourself dealing with an investigation, I wish you well and will genuinely hope you get the quick, focused and painless resolution that these tips are designed to assist. Good luck.